This is the podcast for May 25th, 2012. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just inside the boundary of our number one geopolitical foe, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
And by our number one geopolitical foe, of course, we mean Alan Simpson.
Yes, we do. Old man Simpson. You know, I remember back when I was a senator, the earth was a beautiful place, cooling as it was from...
And now all you gall-darn geezers are ruining it with your poop.
Your poop and your social security and wanting money and stuff. What's wrong with that? You see, and Alan Simpson is one of those guys that I caught wind of. I mean, I had always been aware of him, but he was just retired and he was out of the Senate and he was on NPR. I'm sure I have a post about this from 6 or 7 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. He was on NPR. And he was one of those people who was being interviewed as a former senator who's decrying the fact that the calumny and the anger and the vitriol of the House was seeping over into the Senate. It was becoming an unfit place to work. And again, the person who was doing the interview or the person who was ticking off points pointed to 1 or 2 or 5 or 50 or 1 million Republicans who were being gigantic bomb-throwing assholes. And then it was, well, you know, both sides.
Yeah.
And Simpson will come right up to the edge. He will excoriate his own party, bless his heart. But he always pivots and says, and you know, those guys on the other side are just as bad.
Yeah.
Those liberals are just as crazy. And nobody ever takes a fucking 2x4 to his head, metaphorically, and says, prove it. Show me one. Name one. Where exactly can you point to on the political spectrum you can find one person who's as fucking bad as every one of you fuckers are? Pardon my swearing. But...
Well, and the answer is Alan Grayson, who's not in the Congress anymore.
Yeah. And so, Alan Grayson, who is a tonic.
Yes.
You know? Well, let's go through his policies and see which one of them are crazy.
Yeah.
But we've had this discussion many times before, and there's no point going over it one more time, actually, although we probably will.
We probably will.
Ad infinitum. Once the problem of centrism is solved,
we will end this podcast.
Once somebody finds their fucking breeding ground and salts the earth, burns them to the ground and salts the earth so that we never have another goddamn centrist, except when it is a true case of principled compromise between honest parties.
That's the point. Absolutely.
Then I will forever stop whining about centrism. Once David Brooks becomes a crank that people remember as nuts and scratch their head and go, how the hell did that guy ever get a job at the New York Times? Like, keep it, given all the crap that he spewed every day. How did that ever happen? Once we live in that country, you will never hear another peep about centrism again. Because I used to be a centrist.
Well,
I used to really believe in these things.
Once you decide that it's not tenable to spend $1.74 trillion on a bomber or an airplane, then I'll be willing to sit down with you and talk about austerity or finding savings or finding ways to work within a balanced budget. But if you're dying on the hill of $1.74 trillion for one military project... Don't even bring that up because I will castrate you. That's where I'm at this point.
But, and one of the most amusing and frustrating and, I guess, existentially hilarious plot lines of our great American democracy for the last, I don't know, let's say the last 10 years, but certainly the last 3 or 4, has been watching moderate Republicans and centrist blue dog Democrats like Rahm Emanuel slowly coming around, without ever saying so, to agreeing with everything Howard Dean ever said.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, one day Barack Obama woke up and looked in the mirror and said, holy fuck, the liberals are right about everything. Oh my God, Republicans really are assholes who will destroy this country for political gain. And I have to deal with them on that basis. Now that Rahm Emanuel, we're going to get to this in just a minute, but now that Rahm Emanuel is the mayor of Chicago, and he's a political boss, and there's this lovely write-up of him about how awesome it is he got his budget passed on 50 to zero.
When a Chicago budget has never passed other than 49 to 1, you know, well, Saddam Hussein numbers.
Daily set the whole system is set up so that the mayor is a dictator.
Yeah.
And anybody – I remember when like 2 people voted against Daley's budget, and he spent an entire city council meeting just excoriating them.
Just whining
about the two people who stood against him. The whole system is set up to have it's called a weak mayor, strong council system, but the effect is exactly the opposite. Yeah. The council is basically spineless. The mayor dictates terms, and the terms he dictates are always to the benefit, always redound to the benefit, redound to the benefit of the financial community first, and the citizens second. Now you have to keep the citizens happy, but the whole horrible, hilarious collapse of the city government in Chicago, the way it just unraveled once the money ran out, you just couldn't keep bribing people, is an interesting tale in and of itself, and we'll get to that in just a moment.
Yeah, speaking of big city mayors, though.
Exactly.
We want to start with Cory Booker and sort of his need to hedge, and you know that's such a Wall Street word, but.
Yeah.
Hedge his bets in favor of vulture capitalism. Mm-hmm. And we got a letter this week from Newark. Mm-hmm. And I want you to read it. It's a great letter.
It is.
And we're so grateful to all of you who write us at proleftpodcast@gmail.com. But this one came into our email, and we definitely wanted to include it in our podcast this week. So
right up front, yeah.
Would you please
I'd be happy to. And as I read this, keep in mind Harry Truman – the senator from Prendergast. Harry Truman was a political tool of a terribly corrupt machine because that's the only political game in town.
That's the only way he could make any progress.
Absolutely. Right. And it used to kill him to have to basically give in to bribes and hire people who were hacks and pay off boss Prendergast to get the roads paved. But that was the deal he made. And just keep that in mind as you read this wonderful email from a denizen of New Jersey and a listener who writes, "Dear Driftglass and Blue Gal, thank goodness you podcast once a week. That is a sentence I never thought would come dancing off my fingertips, but there it is. Because you won't have weighed in on the Cory Booker Meet the Press interview until Friday, I can contribute what I think is a helpful insight. Mayor Booker has been lionized in the press for the more stunt-like events of his tenure, but these bits of brain candy do not give a true picture of the problems this mayor has fought to overcome. The first hurdle to solving problems of Newark was for Booker to be elected. That election was detailed in the documentary film Street Fight. I acknowledge that the film was biased towards Booker, but if even half the scurrilous things incumbent Mayor Sharp James supposedly said, indeed did get said, then it was a very nasty mayoral race. If negative campaigns make Cory Booker nauseous, this is probably not an exercise in naive false equivalence. It's probably PTSD. The second accusation, pandering to the moneyed elites, may also be construed very differently. Mayor Booker does need money. Mayor Booker does need money. It is not, however, for re-election, but for Newark, New Jersey itself. Jobs for the many unemployed people in Newark will not drop from the sky, nor will they float up out of the Hackensack River. Moreover, there needs to be a more solid tax base in the city so that programs can be funded. There are initiatives to provide legal aid to immigrants and to reintegrate prisoners into society and to give help to single mothers. These cannot exist without money. Let Driftglass underscore how true this is. And ethical businesses and investments can bring in this money. If Cory Booker tries to express the idea that there are good capitalists out there and that he would be happy to sit down with some of them, he may have a legitimate reason for doing so. I teach at the county college that sits in the heart of downtown Newark. And I have seen how small businesses come and go and how my students struggle to find work and dig themselves out of intractable poverty. With a governor like Christie, Mayor Booker has to look in a lot of different places to find the help for his people. I would hope that good journalists would look deeper than a soundbite on Meet the Press, which I know you two would know better than to respect, and think more deeply about the origins of statements and opinions of a good working mayor. If I'm wrong about Cory Booker, I'd prefer to be proven wrong with studied, factual, diligent reporting and not barely considered paragraphs of opining. This is what I have been hearing, and I count on you two for something better. Aw. We're no better than that.
we've been talking all week about how that Harold Ford dollar is a good dollar. That Harold Ford Jr. dollar is a good dollar. Yeah. But continue. Let's finish the letter and then let's talk about
it. Let me end by saying that I look forward to your podcast every Friday, and I would love to help you financially. My problem is that I'm an adjunct professor of an inner city county college. Say no more, pal.
Yeah.
When things turn around for me, I'll share the wealth with you. Yours truly, et cetera.
We thank you very much for the letter. And
absolutely.
Really glad to get it because it does put things in perspective that, you know, Newark is not an easy city to be a mayor of. And he has turned around that city in terms of its national image by being the superhero that he has been.
He has.
And mastered social media in ways that a lot of people are unable to do.
And is apparently just indefatigable. I mean, he just never gets tired and stays on the job. Harold, I will say, along with Blue Gal, that Harold Ford dollar is a really good dollar.
Yeah.
And that moderate Republican, let's all get along bullshit dollar. But Harold Ford doesn't govern anything except own bank account.
Yeah.
I have immense respect for mayors of big cities in America who have to do deals with the people every day to get the potholes filled and the schools open on time and have unions to deal with, good and bad unions to deal with, and have all the realities of running a major American city in a time of massive economic collapse when the federal government has basically turned their back on them and said, screw you, you're on your own. I have a great deal of sympathy for that. So for context, I would say that this sounds like a blend of Harold Washington and Rahm Emanuel in a certain way. Harold Washington, as I'm sure some of you out there remember, won election against bitter, bitter opposition, bitter racist opposition. A whole bunch of city councilmen who had been Democrats their entire life switched parties just to vote against him. They ran this goof named Bernie Epton against him. And this is a guy who ran up the middle. He was a machine politician. And he ran up the middle between Jane Byrne and young Richie Daley. And the thing that turned it around was Harold Washington in a public debate where you could hear how incredibly inarticulate and really semi-literate Richie Daley was compared to the very literate, very articulate, very smart, very agile Harold Washington. And he ran right up the middle between Jane Byrne and Daley and won the Democratic nomination. And the campaign against him ran under the slogan, Bernie Epton before it's too late. And a whole bunch of people who were lifelong Democrats turned right around in Chicago and voted against him because he was black, hated him because he was black. And his first administration was an exercise in the sudden majority that appeared out of nowhere in city council to stop everything he tried to do. His entire administration was pretty much executive orders because they were absolutely determined to stop him no matter what he did. I can sympathize with Cory Booker if he went through an election like that. It's brutalizing. It's maddening. That's the sort of election that Barack Obama went through. That's the sort of election that Barack Obama is about to go through, where people just hate him and make very clear that they would rather burn the place down than let him have an ounce of power. That being said, Rahm Emanuel is trying very hard in Chicago to run on to take what Daley left behind and make it work. And what Daley left behind was a legacy of this snuggling up to capitalists approach to city government, which works great as long as it's theoretical. But in practice, what it amounted to was not very many years ago, back when I had a different life, I had a meeting with one of Chicago's many chiefs of staff. And I proposed a project for which I had already lined up funding. I had lined up around $4 million in funding for this project that Chicago desperately needed and still desperately needs today. And I was told by that chief of staff to the mayor of Chicago that they didn't need the money, so forget about it. They had plenty of money, so go away, little boy, go away. That's what happens when a city has lots of money. It can do lots and lots of things. When Chicago went into debt, its mayor started hawking everything he could lay his hands on. But even after he hawked the parking meters, he sold them for $1.1 billion. He sold them at fire sale prices. He got screwed on the deal. His city council approved it. Everybody knew it was a disastrously bad idea, and yet they did it anyway because we had reached the point where we simply acceded to the demands of the private market. We simply accepted the fact that government just doesn't work anymore because there's no more tax revenue. We can't really tax anybody. So we're just going to sell off our assets. We're going to monetize our programs some other way. And that has come back to haunt Rahm Emanuel big time, as everyone knew it would. Daly took $1 billion+ that was supposed to last for 40 years and spent it all in two to prop up his administration. And now all that money is gone. And now Daly has a job with one of the law firms that set the deal up. And
who? How long were the parking meter money? How long was that supposed to last?
It was supposed to last for decades. It was supposed to last for, you know, the it's a lease, but it's a 75-year lease. So it was effectively selling the entire thing. It was supposed to last. It was a rainy day fund that was supposed to last for decades. And it lasted 2.5 years, 3 years, just enough time for Daly to prop up his way overspending administration so he could leave as a hero. He took taxpayer assets, sold them off, and spent the money to make himself pass into history gloriously instead of admitting that he had basically bankrupted the city on a lot of shit that didn't work, hiring a lot of people that were his friends, trying to do a lot of crazy shit that made the city look beautiful but never quite got paid for. He bought a lot of labor peace and a lot of neighborhood peace by throwing money at problems, by co-opting everybody, by just promising to write checks to everybody. And when the money ran out, he didn't know what to do. So he started selling off the copper pipes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, because Rahm Emanuel just had an announcement about building a new cargo area out at O'Hare, and he's got millions of dollars to do that. And every time something like this comes out, I keep thinking to myself, I thought the city was broke.
Yeah.
I thought we didn't have money for a $1.74 trillion airplane. Well, you know, the city, apparently the House Republicans think we do, and Rahm Emanuel, there's always money for stuff, and I don't understand it.
Well, because there is always money for stuff. Because some people will always have a place at the table and plenty on their plate. And it's there's, as I've said a million times, there's a club. Mm-hmm. And baby, you and I are not in it. Most of the people I know aren't in it. But I do know people who still work in city government, even after many, many, many layoffs. And the buzz is Emanuel is going to do what Daly never got a chance to do, which is privatize everything. Privatize emergency services, privatize human resources, privatize health services. He's already in the process of outsourcing the entire workforce system to a public-private partnership. I mean, he's simply giving up the idea of governing. The idea always was for Daly, it'd be Richie Daly and 50 contract analysts sitting on the fifth floor privatizing everything.
Yeah.
Then they wouldn't have to worry about unions or people showing up to work on time. You could just hire and fire companies and reap the rewards and get the benefits. And Daly did. Again, he is now working for a lot of money at one of the outfits that rigged up this deal. Mm-hmm. The spokesperson for the finance people at Morgan Stanley, who arranged the deal, is Avis Lavelle, who is one of Mayor Daley's former press secretaries. There's always a soft place to land for these people. And mm-hmm. believe it when I say Rahm Emanuel will find just such a welcoming place when he leaves. But in the interim, the parking company that the city sold this thing to is now dunning the city for $22 to $50 million. Because they claim they're losing revenues due to disability placards and closed streets and blah, blah, blah. But they presented the city with a $22 million, possibly $50 million bill the city was not expecting, because that's what happens when you work with a private company. You have disputes over contracts. You have disputes over the terms of the contracts. You have disputes over all kinds of little things buried in the fine print that let that company get paid for all kinds of things. You know when you never have these disputes? When those people work for you, when those people are your actual employees, when the parking meters belong to the city and the people that service them are employed by the city, they get paid a salary, a handsome salary to be sure, but they do the work and they don't show up at the end of the day and say, by the way, you still owe us $22 million. Screw it if you're broke. And this is the consequence of privatization. This is the consequence of outsourcing stuff to the private sector, because they're in it for the money. And every contract you write is filled with little tiny landmines that will blow up in your face once that company gets a hold of the contract. That's the price you pay for deciding that government no longer works, or the government should work like a business. So, hey, fuck it. Let's just make it a business. And that's
well, and now I wanted to talk to you a little bit about protests in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from another listener of ours saying, you know, what a week. You've got the NATO protests going on. And then yesterday there was just a huge turnout in Chicago for the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yeah.
You know, he stole our 4% raise and then he cussed us out, you know,
yeah.
Which is what Rahm Emanuel does. That's sort of what. But apparently there were thousands of...
Yeah, streets were full.
The streets were full. Mm-hmm. And so is that powerful enough? What is the dynamics of that kind of argument with ROM and the unions? And what does that say for larger issues with Wisconsin and every place else where public unions are under attack by these big city mayors who pretend to be progressive?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of unions in Chicago, mm-hmm. and big and small. In fact, there's a Federation of Labor that owns a lot of property in Chicago and is very powerful. Not as powerful as it used to be, but pretty powerful. Some of the people who run unions are horribly corrupt and atavistic and still believe it's 1954. Some of the people who run unions are forward-thinking and progressive and understand they have to change, and their members have to be held to some greater level of accountability for outcomes than they might have been in the past. Mm-hmm. They also realize there's very little money. Unions still can bring a lot of pressure to bear on the mayor. They can make the mayor look bad. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to negotiating, they're really behind the eight ball. Because they're and this is, you're going to be surprised to hear me say this, but I wish there were an active, robust Republican Party in Chicago.
Yeah.
I really do. Because it's a one-party city. It always has been. Mm-hmm. There is an active, robust Republican Party downstate, and it runs everything else. And it runs it just as badly and as corruptly, et cetera. And corrupt deals are made between these two parties to divvy up the state and take home their spoils. And it has been going on for years. But that's the way the state of Illinois is run. It is a corrupt system. And it is something that is called in Chicago the Combine.
Yeah.
It's this
upstate, downstate.
Yeah. It's why they call it organized crime. Mm-hmm. It is an institution. It's a corrupt corporation of crime that survives the ups and downs of individual members. But the truth of the matter is, Chicago has probably enough money to run a major city. It is horribly misallocated, and their priorities are screwed up, and there's a great terror of raising taxes on anyone for any reason at all. Chicago is an indispensable city. The Midwest, the upper Midwest certainly cannot survive without that center. As big and as obnoxious and as pushy, as demanding, and as much as they suck resources out of a lot of other places, you can't get around it. You have to deal with Chicago. The mayor is from Chicago. The chief of staff is from Chicago. The president's from Chicago in one way or another. So being a large union inside of that political universe, you have buttons you can push and you have levers you can yank on. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But it never hurts to remind a municipal mayor, a person running a municipal system, not a congressman, not a senator, but a person who has specific municipal responsibilities for paving the streets and keeping the schools open. It never hurts to remind him that there are tens of thousands of people out there who can make or break him, who can make him look bad, and there's no place for him to go. He is responsible to them, and he's accountable to them. And the people I know in the union, I know several people in the teachers union, are for the most part very reasonable. Some of them hate their jobs because sometimes they have to defend really indefensible, obnoxious, horrible behavior. And I wish that weren't true. I wish unions were as pure and pristine as corporations are. But they're not. They're human institutions full of people who will abuse power if they get too close to it. But they represent working people. And it's terribly important that we not forget that working people matter. And once we've decided working people don't deserve protection because the instruments of their protection can sometimes be corrupt, that's the day we become a feudal system.
Well, and I think that's one of the problems that we're dealing with politically in this country is you talk about how there's a club and we're not in it. I think white seniors have always felt that they were in a club.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been convinced by the media that they watch, let's just put it that way, that club is about being white and being conservative and being Republican rather than being citizens.
Yeah.
And because if it's just about being citizens, then other people get those rights too, and that it's a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not the case. I'm not going to get into theology here, but I do think there's a theological aspect to it of – people who believe in universal salvation, who believe that God loves everybody, and then there are people who believe, no, there's a chosen few.
Yeah,
and it just boils right over into politics, those two sides of the theological coin. If you believe God loves everyone, or and you're in that universalist mode, then it's much easier to see each individual as having the same rights as you do, and it's not a zero-sum game. Whereas if you can only be saved by doing X, Y, and Z, then, no, that person doesn't get rights. They haven't been chosen the way I have. You know, they're taking away from me anytime they get something. And it's hard to fight someone's personal theology, but I think that's sort of the core of where things are.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to go off on that tangent, but...
No, it's a good tangent, and it leads us right into the realm of the things that which you cannot say.
Yeah, which we've gone over many times, but this week has been a real bubbling over, especially with Mark Halperin's interview with Mitt Romney.
With Mittens.
And as I said to on my email list, I said, you know, if the press is going to start eating their own, please start with Mark Halperin.
Yeah.
You know,
he's soft and slow moving. He's delicious, I'm sure. Go after him first.
And I loved what Wonkette said. They said that this is related to that. They said you can actually get a job as a CNN political director if you can type that which Mitt Romney says. You know, that's all you have to do.
Absolutely.
And that's what Mark Halperin did. He just sort of, you're going to bring unemployment down to 6%, but then didn't mention that's exactly where the projections say it will be in 5 years. And 2 weeks ago, not 2 years ago, 2 weeks ago, you said Barack Obama was a failure for not bringing it down to 4. And we don't do any of that context because, as the press secretary said yesterday also on Air Force One, you guys are lazy.
Well, they're lazy. And the other example was apologizing.
Yeah.
Apologizing to dictators around the world, which is an absolute through line in Republicans. Scratch conservative, you'll hear about how Barack Obama went around the world apologizing. Sean Hannity says it.
Yep.
Mitt Romney says it incessantly. And it's just a flat out lie. It's one of the many, many, many lies that Republicans tell that nobody calls them on because that just isn't done anymore. We just don't it's just not – everyone I think has figured out that it doesn't matter that you call Republicans out on their lies. It just doesn't stop them.
And one of the things that's completely related to this is the peeking under the rug that we got from David Corn, Joan Walsh, and Chris Matthews yesterday, where it wound up with Chris Matthews saying, well, you know, Mark Halperin never would have gotten that interview if he'd been hard on Mitt Romney, if he'd actually faced up to the fact that Mitt Romney was sitting there lying to him.
Exactly. And Joan Walsh, very, very – and this is – Mark Halperin is a complete – let's be clear, a complete fucking tool.
Yeah.
And has been kicked off the air before. He was in the penalty box for 1 month for
calling the president a dick.
A dick. Yeah. And then he was rehabilitated by his good friend David Gregory. And then he was pronounced, you know, just like Newt Gingrich. It doesn't matter how badly Mark Halperin fucks up or how often he's wrong. He's a massive hack.
And Newt Gingrich is on Hardball this week.
But
we're waiting for Meet the Press just any day now.
Yeah, our prediction is June. But there's a real club. I mean, I say this in jest sometimes, but there is a real club and there are real people in it and there's nothing they can do to get kicked out of it.
Yep.
There's nothing they can do to fuck up so badly that they're going to be taken off the air. And Mark Halperin interviewed Mitt Romney and Mitt Romney basically pissed in his face.
Yep.
And we cut to.
And
Joan
he said,
Walsh.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a delightful interview. And then they cut to. You know, Joan Walsh and David Corn and
well, first of all, they had Mark Halperin on.
Yes.
And Tweety, Chris Matthews says, always great to have you on. Awesome interview. Wonderful. Fabulous. You were great. We're so proud of you. Blah, blah, blah. Then we go on to David Corn and Joan Walsh. You know, Mark Halperin is scooted off the stage and it's like, you know, he was lying the whole time. Don't we have any responsibility for saying so?
As we're – and this is a through line that was picked up by Rachel Maddow.
Last night.
And she said, I'm not talking about bloggers or snarky people or Blue Gallon Drift Glass. She didn't mention us by name, but she was talking.
She was thanking us. We know she
totally
was. We love you too, Rachel. It's okay.
But I'm talking about working political journalists. you know,
inside the Beltway journalists. This is a test for them, she said.
This is a test.
Absolutely. Yep.
And Mark Halperin colossally failed the test. But what his colleagues did was they could only very gently point out the fact that, hey, maybe if you weren't a complete fucking ass-licking dick, maybe if you actually did the job of a journalist, when the candidate pisses in your face and lies to you, you might want to mention that to him or call him out on it or challenge that lie that he's telling that you goddamn well know is a lie.
But in Mark Halperin's defense, Driftglass,
yes,
that's not his job.
Yes, as Chris Matthews said, well, then yeah, he wouldn't have gotten the interview.
And his job is not, his yeah, job is not to find the truth. His job is to keep this a horse race until November, yeah, so that mm-hmm, people will continue to tune in and advertisers will continue to funnel the revenue to that network. That's his job, and he's doing his job. He will say great news for Mitt Romney all frickin' summer long,
uh-huh,
and that's his job.
Uh-huh. Because he's
and he'll be on Morning Joe, and he'll be on Chris Matthews, and he'll be on and on and on because his job is to keep this race close and quote-unquote fair, no matter how much of a liar Mitt Romney is.
And come November or December, he'll have a new book out.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. And that's how Mark Halperin...
Yeah. The Race to Win, 2012. Yeah,
yeah,
you know.
That's how, that's
and
how
there
Mark
will
Halperin
be,
made,
as there was with his last book, mm-hmm, a big launch party inside the Beltway where Hillary Clinton and John McCain and all of these Beltway insiders will show up and go, oh, Mark, great to see you. Mm-hmm. It's a circle jerk. And there's
only,
nothing...
And only every now and then, and only on MSNBC do we ever see anyone get so indignant about how complete a tool people like Mark Halperin are. They actually rise up on their hind legs and said, well, maybe you should not do that. Maybe you should do the fucking job of a journalist and ask a hard question. They never quite say that, but they just...
No, well, even Rachel Maddow couldn't say Mark Halperin's name at the end of her segment.
No, she
you
just
failed.
Said political
journalist. She said,
journalist.
You failed. Yeah. But she couldn't say, you failed Mark Halperin.
We'll
yeah,
show a montage with Mark Halperin's face on it. And then we'll talk about political journalists, and I'll let you figure out. But as we talked about yesterday, having seen this, yeah, we don't have these people on speed dial. These people don't talk to us. Yeah. But there is an incredibly powerful tool called deductive reasoning,
yeah,
called reverse engineering. You can figure out the shape of a thing without actually having to see it by the effect it has on the things around it. The effect David Gregory has, another massive, well-paid douchebag whose job it is to let Republicans lie as much as they want about all the things they want to lie about. Rachel Maddow will never call him out.
Yeah.
Will never, ever sit right next to him on the table because he's the boss, because he's the big dog, because that's where the big dollar is, because that's what the company wants him done. And so we will never mention that David Gregory is part of the problem when we're excoriating political journalists. We'll never mention that Mark Halperin is not doing an honest job of an honest journalist and knows it. But he knows that his job is to be a liar, and he's really, really good at that job. We will never mention, except for the point of a gun, that George Will's wife is a Republican marketing person.
Yep.
And a prominent one in D.C. Only after somebody pointed a gun at his head did he admit it on camera. We will never mention the Mike Barnicle.
Oh, this came out this week when they were interviewing Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. And Colin Powell made some joke about my wife never called me at work. And then Joe Scarborough said, hey, Mike, maybe you shouldn't be calling your wife over at Wall Street Bank of America all the time. And I just about peed my pants. I'm sorry, but Mike Barnicle's wife works for Bank of America Wall Street? What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
He's the liberal on that show.
I know.
Oh, and I said, you know, Mike, when you're done talking to your wife, hand the phone over. I want to call the suicide prevention hotline because it's over.
Well, and Paul Krugman will never call out David Brooks by name. He'll never call out Tom Friedman by name.
There's this collegial protection racket.
There's this thing. And if David Brooks writes another column about structuralists versus cyclicalists, Paul Krugman will say, these goddamn structuralists are full of shit.
Yeah.
But he will never mention David Brooks by name. He'll never mention Tom Friedman by name. David Gregory's wife was lead attorney fixer for Fannie Mae.
She was one of the top three people at Fannie Mae who was resigned in order to facilitate the bailout. You had to let heads roll. Three people had to let their heads roll. She was one of them, David Gregory's wife. So
and
it's a club.
And there are certain rules that everyone signs up to, even the people we love. Sign in blood, thou shalt not take on, and there's a list of names or subjects or whatever. You will not call out a colleague on the air, even if your colleague is actually oozing pustulant plague. And the question, and you're having your stories about a particular form of disease, and your colleague is patient zero.
Yeah,
we will not mention him by name because that would be bad for business.
Right.
And you can just see them straining, trying to operate within this inherently corrupt system. So that's why the message is a failure. That's why you don't hear about these things in the media, because it is absolutely prohibited from talking about them. We can hint at them. We can whistle about them. We can say bad things as long as we say both sides do it. But we're not allowed in our political media to talk about the real problems we're faced with. The real political problems that one side is fucking crazy.
And on that note, we're going to switch gears one more time and read a letter that I think is really important. And we've actually discussed this person on the air before.
Uh-huh.
And she writes, "Dear Driftglass and Blue Gal, this week," meaning last week's podcast, "you mentioned a past letter from a Georgia listener whose husband would lose clients if they came out as liberals. I'm not sure if that letter was from me." Well, it was from her. "And as I did write that very thing to you about this time last year, and I do live in Georgia. However, I felt I had to write to tell you that I wish that were all that was at stake now. It's so much worse. To live in the Deep South at this time and come out as a liberal has now moved into the dangerous category. The few people that riled my husband enough with their bigotry and hatred for Obama and finally pushed him into outing himself as a liberal no longer do business with him. He was respectful, but voiced his opposing opinions to theirs and never saw them again. One of my sons, who worked tirelessly alongside of us to get Obama elected, has been chastised daily at his job because he was seen collecting voter registrations on the side of town where the blacks live. If he were anything less than the most decent and kind kid you could ever meet, I would worry for his safety. But people like him quite a lot, despite his being the only liberal in his large workplace. He keeps his opinions to himself, but they constantly jab at him with comments about how Obama has ruined all of their lives, even though, if confronted, they cannot say how. My other son and his wife packed up and moved from here to get away from the ignorant and hateful people that surround us. It was one of the most painful days for all of us as a family, but their sanity was at stake, so we wished them well that day, and then I wept for 2 straight weeks. My little family has been my only sanity for 25 years in a place I detest, and losing them was so hard, but their happiness came first for me. Mm-hmm. Yes, my husband and I chose to stay for financial reasons and job security, and it has certainly bonded our families in ways I could never regret. But to say we are now done is an understatement. When we first arrived here, we thought things would progress and more liberals would arrive and dilute the Southern ideology that permeates this community. Alas, that has not been the case. In fact, it's been just the opposite. The South has for years been attracting all the misplaced right-wingers from more liberal areas of the country who long to be with their kind as well. I call it the Great Sort. Yeah. It's happening. People are migrating to be with like-minded people, and I have to wonder where this will end. I know we are certainly doing our homework to find a more liberal area to live after retirement. One can't look ahead and not wonder if there just might be a civil war in America's future, because we will never see the world the same way. As the internet is bringing together so many different cultures and ideas, people are being affronted daily that their little way of life is no longer the way of life. And it's a bitter pill for many to swallow. I mentioned things being dangerous when I started my letter, and it's true. These days I keep to myself. I find that having to oppress who I really am at any given moment in the community feels like I am betraying who I really am. However, to out us at this time feels not only like a huge threat to our financial security, but now I truly fear for our property, and even for our very lives. These people have gone nuts down here. As they sense another possible, yes, even likely win for Obama in November, they are losing it. Mm-hmm. So outing ourselves is even more frightening than it was back then. They've become nearly vicious in their hatred for the left, and it's scary. And here's the really important part of her letter. This is about the obsessive need not to lose. From what I see, people that fluctuate to the right in politics and religion have developed within their consciousness a pathological need to never be wrong and to never lose out to anyone on anything. Driftglass is always mentioning how the people on the right can't admit they've been wrong about anything. That's because to do so is like a death to them. They need to be right, and they need to win at all costs. They are like Terminators. You can't stop them because within their psyches they would rather die than lose. These are extremely narcissistic people who are always looking out for themselves. They see the world in the context of who is taking from me, the government, the welfare queens, the police officer using his car off duty, their taxes, all of it. They get up in the morning and put on a pair of glasses that keeps them focused all day on where they are losing out to someone or something. So they're always pissed off. It's all about me, me, me for them. The left are far more likely to put on a pair of glasses that keeps them focused on how to create a world that's better for all. Mm-hmm. This great chasm between us appears to me, for the first time in my life, nearly impossible to unite. In fact, the divide is ever widening in my view. As we on the left show more love for all, they on the right will feel more loss and fight to the death to win. I believe love will win in the end. However, what I'm unsure of is how. That remains to be seen. On that note, I'd like to thank you very much for bringing more love into my life every week with your podcast. You and a few others are like water in the desert for me because you care about others. I'm very grateful, and after clicking send on this email, I'll be donating again to your podcast to show my appreciation. Well, thank you.
It's all a fundraiser, guys.
No, it's all... not, really. It's
no,
not.
No,
best
no.
of luck in your job search, Driftglass. And Blue Gal,
thank you.
Yeah, Blue Gal, your sincere tears during various podcasts have been proof that you are love. Never be ashamed of that. I won't be outing myself anytime soon down here in the midst of Satan's army. But I will continue to do all I can from my underground bunker to support the left. Thanks for being there each week. Best mm-hmm. regards. And you and I have talked many times about, you know, is a civil war coming? And
yeah.
and how does that
it's here.
Play out?
It's here.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
happening every time an abortion doctor gets shot and
yeah.
people cheer. It's, you know, this is, there are many little Fort Sumters happening all around us. Now, if it ever, I don't know if it'll ever evolve into a big ass shooting war with hundreds of thousands of people, but this, there's just, this is something we have to face on the left.
Yeah.
Well,
that, and I was thinking about that Colorado congressman who's had yeah. to walk back his statement that Obama's not an American in his heart.
Who wouldn't walk it back?
Yeah.
Who apologized like a you know felon taking the Fifth Amendment?
Yeah. Yeah.
But wouldn't
yeah.
apologize for it because you can't apologize because no. you can't admit you're wrong because then the liberals win, and it's all about making liberals cry because liberals are responsible for everything. My bursitis, my sciatica, I lost my job, my wife won't love me anymore. I'm a drunk. My kids hate me. All of that is liberals are responsible for all of that. And they really – they're all fucking Archie Bunker. They're fucking Archie Bunker with guns, and that's the problem. This is in fact, a big topic of what – I was interviewed on KOPN.
Yeah.
89.5, Columbia, Missouri's news leader.
Which we will have at our podcast. We will be posting yeah. that as a bonus podcast for everybody next – when they send us the MP3. That's all I can tell you. They said a couple weeks.
And but for the damn Girl Scouts.
Yeah, if I hadn't had to take my daughters to a – liberal, hippie, commie Girl Scout meeting where they learned about environmentalism and water preservation and stuff like that.
Property is theft, Blue Gal.
I would have been in this interview too, but yeah. I was busy turning my daughters into socialists.
Well, and you know, brown shirted socialists, I might add, because of the Girl Scouts.
Well, green shirted, yeah.
Brown sashed.
Yeah, brown sashed. They were brown sashed for their brownie meeting. Yes, they were.
But we talked about. I mentioned to Greg the book, a book that I touch on every now and then by M. Scott Peck from the '70s called "The People of the Lie," which is a clinical psychologist's analysis of people who were coming to him, who very few patients to be sure, but who were evil, and he. Found characteristics common to all of them and found certain things they did and the way they approached the world and the way they took the roiling, corrupting evil, the terrible lie at the center of their lives, and they projected it out onto the universe. And then they attacked the universe as evil. They were rigid. They were moralistic. They were very weird in the way they talked about themselves. They were
very
convoluted.
Child rapists, and they were
yeah.
really abusive people. And the people in that book are
terrifying.
Really scary. Yeah, like out of some sort of horror movie.
And yet they manifested themselves in their community as starched, upright, pure, moralistic Christians who would freak out if anybody ever suggested that they were anything less than perfect, because everyone else is the problem, not me. But that's the problem. And he pointed out the problem with all of these people is they had built their entire personality on a lie. And eventually they had to devote the entire sum of their psychic and emotional energy to defending that lie. Because as you and I talked about, it comes down to, what if you had a bomb in your head? And if you ever apologized, if you ever even admitted you were wrong, it would explode and kill you. That's what it's like to be a conservative. It's not a political position anymore. It's not a point of view about budgets or deficits or foreign policy. It's about never admitting that liberals are right, ever, about anything. And that Ronald Reagan was a god who never raised taxes, and America's the greatest goddamn country God ever created, and anyone who says different is a fucking liar. And every time that philosophy brushes up against reality and gets a rude shock to the face, you have two choices. Admit there might be some problem with your worldview, or double down on the crazy. And they have this bomb in their head. If they ever have to admit that they got anything wrong, the liberals are right, their personalities, their religious, their cultural identities would implode. Therefore, they cannot do it. Therefore, they seek out demagogues like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, who will gladly feed them lie after lie after lie, as long as they get back from them votes and money and faith and rage. And this perverse cycle, this horribly corrupt cycle, is what drives the right further and further and further to the right. And that's just a fact. As far as I'm concerned, debate about that is over. I don't want to see another chart from Ezra Klein or the study from the Pew Institute explaining that, hey, Fox News views are really really misinformed. I wonder why that is. I don't want to have this discussion anymore. This has been litigated and settled. They're crazy. I'm not having that discussion anymore. I'm interested in how we corral them, how we provide sort of cultural prophylactics to prevent them from destroying our culture until they die a natural death. And the only way to do that is to have that discussion about them in public. This reminds me of Ronald Reagan refusing to say AIDS.
Yeah.
The press refuses to say. The press absolutely refuses to say that the right is crazy and that they run the GOP and that they are run in turn by Fox News. The press will not say that, because the consequences of saying that in terms of dollars and cents and prestige and beltway position would be a catastrophe. So these people have bombs in their heads that will explode if they're ever wrong. And that's a fact. And we have a press in the middle that will not talk about that fact. Now, one of these things is changeable. One is not.
Yeah.
The Beltway media is responsive to pressure, to economics, to embarrassment, to public derision, to actual outside events can push them in one direction or another. Conservatives cannot be saved. They can only be held at arm's length until they shrivel up and die. And so that's why I focus so much of my energy and attention on the centrist lie and the complicit role of the media in pretending that this horror show is not going on at all. Mm-hmm. And thus ends my little speech.
Well, and I just wanted to bring up one last point, this point about West Virginia. 40% of West Virginia Democrats voting for a man in prison rather than voting for Barack Obama in the primary.
With a mullet.
A mullet.
Yeah.
And someone pointed out that, Barack Obama is seen in West Virginia also quite rightly as being slightly anti-coal. And so therefore they actually had a legitimate reason for voting against Barack Obama. And I said, no, because Hillary was anti-coal too. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that she won the West Virginia primary because she was more pro-coal than Barack Obama. It's because she was white. And I'm not hitting on Hillary Clinton for that.
No.
But this is racism. That's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to recognize that, you're not going to fix a racist unless you're able to transform them spiritually. And I'm more than willing to pray for racists to find the light and realize that we're all one grand family. You know, I'm willing to do that. But politically, you're not going to change these folks. They are racists. And it's deeply sad. And they're in our party. I mean, we have to start thinking about that, too. That this was a closed primary in West Virginia. Registered Democrats only. And the resentment and the closed-mindedness within our own party in certain parts of this country is pathetic.
Well, and I'll note that there's this is a complete aside, but there's an interesting Dave Weigel piece, I think, in Slate or Salon, one of those S magazines that are online that all the kids are reading these days, about essentially whither liberal billionaires. Conservative billionaires are devoting, and you know, rich crackpots on the right are devoting infinite resources to driving moderates out of the party, to purifying their ranks. But when you go to liberals, liberal billionaires, liberal fundraisers, they don't want to do any of that. They don't want to. They know it's not what I do, and going to the sewer, and that's just. And I'm reminded of that scene from Recount, where was it William Christopher, the guy who was running the Gore campaign, was talking in high pious tones about it doesn't really matter if we lose. Because this isn't a street fight. This is a great democracy, and you know, there's nobility no matter what happens, and it's awesome how democracy plays itself out. And he was talking in great big rich round tones about worldviews and shit. Then you cut over to the Bush campaign, this Jim Baker going, "This is a street fight. This is about who wins and loses. However the fuck you have to do it, do it." And that's what infuriates me about rich liberals. Is that they don't want to get their skirts dirty with playing dirty, with fighting back on the ground level. And they don't want to fund anybody who does those things because that's sort of nasty and it smells bad and it might stink up my parlor.
And so
we keep losing because they have an infinite supply of money to draw on to fund every crackpot organization from Alec on down to the local PTA. And we don't. And it's not like we don't have people in our ranks who could fund those things. They just don't want to.
Yeah, well, and there's a really good, you're going to have to help me pronounce his name, really good article in The Atlantic by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I did it.
Ta-Nehisi, I think. But yeah, he's a great writer.
And he writes about this Appalachian resentment, white resentment, Obama in Appalachia is the name of the article.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how these analysts who said, well, you know, racism is only one factor in the white resentment of Obama as liberal and Muslim and pro-gay and all these things. Racism is just one factor. So we can't really blanketly call these people racist. And this guy, his article is basically, you know, you can't say – this can't be chalked only up to race. Because chalking up slavery only to race is deeply distorting.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's true. But if you also can't say that, well, racism is only one factor without realizing that any racism is unacceptable, period. Well,
and number two, people who say crazy, stupid shit like that, the onus...
Are Chris Saliza, by the way.
Exactly.
That's who he's talking about by name.
Usually it's the National Review Online.
Yeah, it's white inside the Beltway male writers. Yeah.
Or it's conservative jagoffs over at Jonah Goldberg's place who keep acting shocked that there are racists working for us. Oh, my God, we have to get rid of another one and another one and another one. And then pretend that there's no racism involved. And at some point, and we've long passed that point in our culture, the question has to stop being racism is or is not the issue. And the question has to be, why are you so obsessed with pretending that it's not there?
Yeah.
Maybe the person who is raising this
– or diminishing it in some way.
Yeah. They're the problem. Maybe they're the people who need to be asked – Why are you so singularly focused on pretending that a problem does not exist that so clearly does?
Yep.
What about you? And then you find out, oh, they're Republicans.
Yeah.
Chris Williamson.
Or they're centrists trying to make it this and that in both sides. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Kevin Williamson in the National Review Online has this long, horrible article that is the same debate I've been having with conservatives since high school, which is, well, the Democratic Party is traditionally the party of the Klan, blue gal. And he goes through this long, convoluted explanation in print at NRO that essentially stops at 1948 or 1964.
Yeah.
And a bunch of stuff happened after that, but we're not really going to talk about what that was. And it's this, but you know,
yeah,
you
go and it's back to the argument of blacks are perfectly fine as long as they stay in their place and don't vote, right? I mean,
Byrd was a Klansman.
Honestly. I'm so sick of this shit.
That argument falls apart after 2 minutes of any kind of person with any sense
of American history. Yes.
But it still shows up in print all the time. And I laughed at this guy because he just got a house drop on him for writing this shit. But it's in the National Review Online. It's absolute racist bullshit. Yes, you're historically correct as long as you stop looking at America
after the Civil Rights Act.
Civil Rights
Act. What
you pretend the last 50 years never happened. Sure, you have a great point there, but I live in this world, not that one. And secondly, I'm moved to recall that in 2007, David Brooks said pretty much the same thing in the New York Times about Ronald Reagan. There's this scurrilous rumor going around that Ronald Reagan ran a racist campaign because he went to Philadelphia, and he said the same bullshit in the fucking New York Times, and Charles Blow did drop a house on it.
Yeah.
And Paul Krugman and everyone else essentially because David Brooks, history major David Brooks, just skipped over all that part of history that disproved his bullshit thesis. Well, that was 5 years ago, 4 years ago. David Brooks still has a job. You can lie all you want in print if you're David Brooks. You can lie all you want if you're Kevin Williamson. You can lie all you want if you're Mark Halperin because there's a fucking club. And it doesn't matter how many times or how destructive you lie or how many times snarky bloggers point it out to you on their little blogs.
And you'll be rewarded for it with tripling the value of your home. You get to move up and join the country club and you know, you're the 1% now. You know, David Gregory's in the 1% now. Think about that for a minute.
Yes. And he got there by lying.
Yeah.
He got there by dancing with Karl Rove. That's how he got what he got.
On that note, we have to end.
Yes, we do.
Thank you to all of you who've written in to us and sent us contributions and support the work that we do here. We so appreciate it. You can listen to our podcast for free at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, at our Facebook page, on iTunes, and our fabulous app available at the iTunes Store. We're on Stitcher Radio, and we're on Netroots Radio, 6 to 7 Pacific and 9 to 10 Eastern at netrootsradio.blogspot.com. Again, we appreciate your contributions to the podcast. You can contribute using the PayPal button at our website or by sending a contribution to our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. And all of that information is at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. Again, our email address is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. Write to us. And just be aware that unless you say otherwise, we reserve the right to read your letter or email on the air. Every week, we publish a picture of an internet kitty. If you would like to send us your internet kitty to be in the line of succession, because we don't call it a wait list.
No.
It is royal. We would love to have a picture of your internet kitty. Please put the words internet kitty in the subject line of your email so I don't miss it. This week's internet kitty is named Ruby, and I will read what Ruby's human said. Meet Ruby, the alpha cat among five cats at my friend's house. Ruby and I were once roommates until I took sick, and recovery involved living in a rehab facility, so Ruby went to live at Bob's house and became leader of the pack. I'm out of the facility in a month and expect only visits with Ruby and not a new home relationship because she's settled in.
You are who now? You're
yes,
what?
Yes, right. And you are, yes, I can totally understand it. If Ruby became alpha feline among five cats, she's required to maintain her leadership position within the new home.
She ain't going back to Peoria, my friend.
No, that's it. You're done. You're done. So we appreciate your sending us this internet kitty of the week. They continue, she's a real sweetheart, round with the shape of a Macy's Thanksgiving parade balloon, stubby little legs at all. She's adorable. And she's at our website and Facebook page this week. So welcome, Ruby. So Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties figure that Newt Gingrich must have photos of David Gregory's dead hooker.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin'. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2012, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
And I have to say, Driftglass, humbly and with great, you know,
affection.
Ia. You win the bet.
Yep.
You win the bet. We had a bet that when would Newt Gingrich be back on Meet the Press?
Yeah.
And you said June or sooner, and I said it's going to be July 4th weekend. That's my thought was slow news week.
Sure.
He'll be desperate to be on. He'll be on around 4th of July, and you won.
Yeah.
He's on this weekend.
I wrote a nice long
post.
We
both wrote a post about it.
Very lovely artwork you did.
Yeah, I did the Photoshop no one can unsee.
It was never if Newt Gingrich will be back.
No, neither one of us said he'll never be on again. We both knew better than that.
And what prompted it was all the press reports from all the very serious people in Washington about how, his career's over. He's burnt. He's broke. He's dead. He's said too many crazy things. He could never find his way back into the good graces. And we just laughed our asses off.
Yeah. Because he'll be able to meet the press before the end of the summer. We both knew that for a fact.
And how
I have to say that the unpredictability part of this is going to be that it's Mr. Lucky Charms on with him, the governor of Maryland, O'Malley, is going to be on at the same time.
Yeah.
And he doesn't always pull punches, so we will see what happens with that. But I do think Newt Gingrich must have some information that would cause Northrop Grumman's stock to tank. Or, you know, something really dangerous to David Gregory because...
Yeah. This is not the first time this has happened. This is second or third time. Newt Gingrich, after having said scandalous, racist, crazy shit about Barack
Muslims
Obama...
Muslims or, the Kenyan colonialist and,
people said, oh my God, can you believe... And he was hanging out with Pammy Atlas and he rode the whatever bandwagon was going to get his wife more jewelry and sell him more of his crappy tapes and stupid books... whatever racist, bomb-throwing, welfare president, food stamp president bullshit bandwagon he can jump on, he will jump on. This is what drives Rachel Maddow crazy. She has done many episodes about Newt Gingrich is a grifter. Mm-hmm. He's a complete, absolute scam artist. And everybody knows it. Oh, my God. Why does this asshole keep showing up on television? It's not
why
like
isn't
secret.
This guy in jail for mail fraud, for mailing out, you know, we're going to send you a gavel if you pay us such and such a – yeah, he's just a criminal.
He's a criminal and a con artist, and he scams money out of rich his funders, as you and I know from years gone by, there's this lovely IRS database that tells you who contributes to 501c3s. And 3-4 years ago,
You went through the whole list.
The whole
list. I remember.
You know, it was all casino bosses and NASCAR owners.
It's equally shady characters who don't mind having a spokesperson.
Who want to drop a $1 million on a former Speaker of the House who hasn't been in public office since Ally McBeal was on television.
Yeah, exactly.
And have him pimp whatever crazy ass idea they have in exchange for making him rich and keeping his wife in jewels.
Yeah.
And that is his – there's nothing more there. That's all he does. He's an absolute buffoon, racist scam artist. And yet – you and I know for a fact that because David Gregory's job is to be the Underground Railroad for these dicks and that he already has rehabilitated Newt's reputation a couple of times. All of Washington, the whole Washington take on Newt Gingrich would be true. He would be burnt and forever and out of luck and out of work, et cetera, if not for the fact that David Gregory keeps lending him credibility by putting him in front of a camera on Meet the Press.
And asking him serious questions with no context of to his character, his lying to his own constituents for decades, and on and on. So
going on Meet the Press is a license to print money, and David Gregory fucking knows it.
Yeah.
And the reason he gives Newt cachet over and over again after he's spent all of his allowance on the next crazy scheme. And that's why it's a joke. That's why our press corps is a joke, because the most watched and respected television show, political show, is Meet the Press. And it's captained by a complete tool of the establishment who that's what pisses me off. Not that he does this. He's so naked about it. He just drops his trowel and waves Gingrich in our face and says, fuck you. I have a job for life. There's not a fucking thing you can do about it. No one's going to get to me. No one's going to make me stop. No one's going to say shit about this because my
sponsors get richer every day over it.
I get richer every day. And, you know, I'll have my pal David Brooks on next week and maybe Tom Friedman the week after that. Who the fuck knows? But the one thing you can be sure of, my dear audience, is there's not a goddamn thing you can do about it. You know what? My friends at MSNBC will never say a fucking word about it because they know if they do, they're gone. I will cut them off and leave them bleeding by the side of the road. And that's so, the way
I just wanted to end with that, because when we found that out last night, we just
said, hey,
gotta mention this. Yeah. All right, everybody, have a great weekend.
Bye.